And now to matters of personal finance. If you are considering higher education this fall, or one of your children is, now is the time to figure out how to pay for it. One popular way is to try to get financial aid, whether grants or scholarships or student loans. But what you might not know is that deadlines are coming up as early as March in some states. But a lot of students find the process confusing and intimidating. Recently, U.S. Representative Loretta Sanchez, a Democrat of California, hosted a series of seminars on financial aid for her constituents. One group that participated was called Gear Up. That's a program to help low-income students get into higher education. To tell us more about that program, we've called upon Adriana Badillo. She is the director of Gear Up at California State University at Fullerton. Welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Gear Up means?
Gaining Early Awareness and Readiness for Undergraduate Programs.
And that's a national program funded by the Department of Education. Do I have that right?
That's correct.
Tell us a little bit more about the program, if you would.
It's a program to help underserved students to continue their education into post-secondary institutions. So we help them all the way from junior high through our middle school through high school and making sure that they know the information or what steps they need to take so they can apply, enroll, and succeed in an institution of post-secondary education.
Well, you know, you have to assume that a lot of the kids who would, young people, or even perhaps not so young people who are participating in a program like this are probably first-time college attendees. Their parents probably didn't go to college. And you can see where this could be very intimidating. But what are some of the fears, concerns that a lot of the students you work with bring to this process?
I think more than fear is just a lack of knowledge of what steps they need to take. So they don't know where to start. So the goal of Gear Up is to kind of educate them on that regard and find out what is it that we can help them with and get into that transition and get them started.
But what are some of the things that many of these students and families most need to know? I mean, the deadlines obviously is one, but what are the others?
I think what with this population is getting them over that fear that they might not qualify. We are in a very diverse community, even though predominantly most of the students that we work with are Latino. Sometimes, you know, we make the assumptions that we will not going to qualify for that free aid. You know, a lot of the students that we're serving, a lot of them are homeless as well. And you don't want their classmates to know that they don't have a mailing address or a home address. So a lot of the things that our families are going through, they would have to, you know, if they're in a workshop, they feel they might have to say it out loud. For example, a lot of things I've been dealing more closely now when we're helping them with financial aid is, what if my parents file for bankruptcy, or what if we're losing our home? So a lot of the times we just want to make sure that they know that, you know, we can help them. We don't have to advertise what their financial situation is. And I think that's a lot of what we try to do in our job. We work with a lot of students that are immigrants. So maybe their mom or their dad don't have a Social Security. They're not U.S. nationals. So the families don't want to ask anything from them. Or maybe they're in process to getting their green card, or they're just waiting to get their green card. And they don't want to ask for money in fear that they might be removed from the process, or that it will go, you know, against them when they go to their meeting for the Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of issues that we deal with, especially with immigrant families or, you know, or low-income students that I think you also deal with in the general population, but there's other very specific issues that we have to almost comfort them and letting them know that it's okay, we'll work with them. And some of them are a case-by-case scenario.
I'm speaking with Adriana Badillo. She is the director of Gear Up at California State University, Fullerton. That's a program to help low-income students get into higher education programs. She helps teach kids how to get financial aid. What is the one form that everybody should fill out? Isn't there a one sort of central form that everybody should fill? What is that?
That's the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or also known as FAFSA.
FAFSA. So that's a term if you're in this area, you're going to hear the term FAFSA a lot. Tell me a little bit about this.
It's a free form through the federal government where students apply and see what their expected family contribution is, or EFC. And what it is they take into account your latest income information for the prior year, and then what institutions of higher learning you're applying to and what resources a family has. And then they give you a number to what is it you might qualify for. No one else is going to give you that free money if you don't invest that, you know, hour or two in the weekend to fill it out. So it's, you're not going to lose anything by applying and finding out whether you do or not qualify for that free money.
And when you use the word free? Now, this is another question I think a lot of people have. Mm-hmm. In recent years, particularly, I think, related to the mortgage crisis, many people have become acquainted with the idea that there are scams out there. Are there obvious red flags that you want to point out?
Yes, some obvious. There are businesses out there that charge for them to fill out the free application. So we always caution parents and students to be wary of those firms or those companies or those individuals that are charging to do a free process. So making sure that they go to the right website, you know, FAFSA, F-A-F-S-A dot E-D dot G-O-V.
So the .gov is a sign. The .gov means it's something that's run by the government and not by a private corporation, and that should be free. And you're saying if somebody's wanting to charge you money to fill out a form, watch out.
Watch out. Or watch out for someone that might send you a letter home telling you if you come to the seminar, this weekend seminar, if you pay us $100, we guarantee you financial aid. They shouldn't guarantee that.
You're saying that there's no guarantee. There's no magic bullet. There's no magic wand.
There's no magic wand. In the terms of the free application for federal student aid, the federal government has its own formulas that they take into consideration. No one has those formulas, only them. So the family has to apply and find out what they're expected to contribute for the students' higher education expenses.
Okay, is there one piece of advice that you wish you had had before you started this process? I know you're an expert now, but back when you were new at this, is there something you really wish somebody had told you?
Don't be intimidated, and there's always a lot of people willing to help. You just got to look out for that help. You know, a high school counselor are your best bet. And for example, in my case, I didn't go enough to my high school counselor. And sometimes, you know, they're really busy with a lot of students, but making sure that they go out and ask for help, it's the key factor here, because it is an intimidating process. But there's also just as many people trying to help them out. So asking for that help is the first step.
Adriana Badillo is director of Gear Up at California State University Fullerton. She was kind enough to join us from Costa Mesa, California. Adriana, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Just ahead, working moms have all kinds of challenges. They juggle the tensions and trials of a workday with band practice, baseball games, having dinner on the table, and homework. And a new study points out that there's another challenge on that list. Mothers tend to earn less than other working women, especially in certain fields. We've got some thoughts on that from our panel of moms. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The city of Detroit is trying everything it can to revive its school system and stop an exodus of students. They're replacing old buildings, hiring new principals, and getting parents engaged. That means more than just building a PTA, as NPR's Larry Abramson reports in the first of two stories on the Detroit schools.
The effort to involve parents in Detroit education focuses on lots of little things, like the homework corner in Maisha Williams' house on Doris Street.
The homework corner is awesome.
With eight children, five still in school, Maisha Williams' house is packed tight. But unlike many families in this city, she set aside a special corner for homework.
They gave us the bookcase, they did the curtains, they painted the picture frames.
The Detroit Parent Network, a local nonprofit working with the school system, has outfitted the space to look like a classroom with a neat bookshelf and a whiteboard. The message to her kids? Learning deserves an exalted place in the home.
It's just a sense of peace. You just come in and you sit down and you do your homework and you just, you know, it's cool.
The idea is this home will serve as a model that neighbors will emulate. Along with homework skills, DPS is also trying to instill better parenting strategies through workshops across the city. This session is focused on the Hispanic population of the city's west side. Facilitator Marie Isles works with a dozen women in one of the city's many new parent resource centers. They sit and drink coffee in a brightly lit room at Phoenix Elementary. They're talking about the role that parents play in raising achievement.
Now, positive feedback and encouragement to children, what do you think would be some examples of that?
The workshop emphasizes ways to encourage reluctant students. Many of these mothers admit it's hard not to yell when your kids act out or won't do their homework. This resource center, they say, gives ideas on how to instill the value of success. But some behaviors are hard to change.
You still see the kids fighting. It's what they learn at home.
Tina Perez is the kind of parent DPS wants to hold on to. She's committed to her school and to helping other parents, but she might not be able to wait for the schools to improve. Perez says her daughter complains she's already bored with the 8th grade Detroit curriculum.
She goes, Mom, I'm not learning nothing. I don't open my book. I already know what it's about. To me, that's cheating.
Her daughter has applied to a competitive DPS high school. Tina Perez fears if her daughter does not get in, they may have to leave the public school system altogether. For Detroit parents, investing in the school system requires a lot of time. It also takes an element of faith.
Good afternoon to everybody that's here. I want to give kudos to Ms. Lindsay, the president of our LSCO.
This local school community organization has played a role in saving Mumford High School, a troubled but historic school in a middle-class neighborhood. Thanks in part to strong parental support, Mumford has escaped rounds of closures. In fact, it's getting a brand new building. Karen Lindsay, the organization's chair, says she will keep working to improve Mumford even after her daughter graduates this summer.
Now, I'm going to show you something. I want everybody to receive what my daughter gets. That's her transcript. She gets straight A's. She's had straight A's since she's been in Mumford. She plays basketball, ran track. So if my child can do it, everybody's child can do it.
The hope is that attitude will be infectious. Parent involvement will only help if Detroit can address another problem, a history of dismal attendance rates. A look at what it takes to get kids to school in tomorrow's story. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
When a company files to go public, it has to lay out in black and white the biggest risks faced by that company. What could undermine its business model, for instance, or if a key executive plans to leave, anything that could put investors' money at risk. Even though executives are required to do this by law, it can run to many single-space pages. It can also make great reading, as NPR's Steve Henn found out with Facebook.
So I've been flipping through Facebook's IPO filing. And by far, my favorite section is labeled Risk Factors. Sure, there's some gobbledygook, but just the part on mobile advertising is fascinating, if you pull it apart. Roughly half of Facebook's users check in on mobile devices every month. But so far, the company isn't making any money on mobile.
Mobile is a very small screen.
Julie Ask is at Forrester Research. She says mobile ads are tough to do right.
So it's not as if I'm on my PC and there can be advertising on the top or on the side and I can ignore it and still do what I want to do. On a small screen, it's right in front of my face.
A bad mobile ad can muck up the entire Facebook experience.
I'm glad that Facebook isn't making any money on their mobile services for Facebook.
As a customer, Julie Ask might be happy, but as a business, this is a problem Facebook's got to solve. The markets where it needs to grow, like India, Russia, and Brazil, are dominated by mobile devices. Last year, smartphones outsold PCs for the first time ever. Your phone knows where you are and where you're going. It might know you better than your own mother.
I use my phone to bank. I use my phone for Facebook. I use my phone to shop, to change the channel on my TV at home. I read books. I listen to music.
If Facebook doesn't figure out how to make money on mobile advertising, someone else will. Advertisers are salivating. But
if you think about all the things that Facebook knows about us
and what else it can learn using our phones,
I think it can begin to seem a bit creepy.
And that brings us to another big risk facing Facebook's business, privacy.
Privacy is Facebook's Achilles heel.
Jeff Chester is a privacy advocate at the Center for Digital Democracy. He says Facebook's facing increasing scrutiny in Europe over its privacy policies, and the company's executives know new regulations there could tie it in knots.
Facebook has to walk a very difficult digital tightrope.
It has to placate regulators, convince us to keep sharing more and more information, while at the same time building new products that sell billions of dollars in new kinds of highly targeted ads. Julie Ask says, for all that to work, you'd have to trust Facebook almost completely. If it knows as much about you as your mom, you'll need to think about it like your mom.
So what Facebook is going to have to do is make this seem less like Big Brother, less creepy, and more like Big Mother. Somebody or something that's looking out for me, that's helping me make good decisions.
Ask says that's going to be a tough sell. For a company, any company, inspiring that kind of trust is an enormous challenge. She says pulling it off will require a team of brilliant, sensitive social engineers working their butts off. And that brings us to perhaps my favorite risk factor in Facebook's 186-page prospectus. After the IPO, the company's top executives are worried that many of their best and brightest employees will really be too rich to care.
So that is a real risk factor.
Vivek Wadhwa is a fellow at Stanford Law School.
These are young kids we're talking about, typically in their early 20s. Suddenly they have more money than they ever dreamed about.
And that may make staying up all night to work on the next great social app a whole lot less appealing. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Many years ago, a man wrote a long letter of advice to his brother, who was running for the highest office in the land. Among his many pearls of wisdom was this one. Running for office, as wearisome as it is, has the advantage of allowing you to meet and get to know many different types of people you wouldn't normally associate with in your daily life. This is perfectly respectable during a campaign. In fact, you would be thought a fool if you didn't take advantage of it, so that you can eagerly and unashamedly cultivate friendships with people no decent person would talk to. Well, the campaign in question, for the most powerful office in the world, was way back in 64. Not 1964, just 64, 64 B.C., in fact. The campaign was for Consul of Rome, and the advice was from Quintus Tullius Cicero, intended for his brother, the orator, Marcus Cicero. Professor Philip Freeman, a classicist at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa, has provided a translation and an introduction to this little landmark in the history of political consulting. It's called How to Win an Election, an Ancient Guide for Modern Politicians. Philip Freeman, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
And first, tell us about Cicero's campaign and why his brother thought the candidate was in need of advice.
Well, Cicero was, first of all, an outsider. He was not part of the Roman nobility, and he was certainly not in line to rise to the consulship, to the highest office in Rome. Also, he was a bit shy and reserved, and he was not particularly good at associating, making small talk with people. So Quintus decided to give him this no-holds-barred advice about how to win an election, all the down and dirty facts.
And there's one piece of wisdom at the beginning that I found most striking and sounded to me most modern. He said, every day as you go down to the forum, you should say to yourself, I am an outsider. I want to be consul. This is Rome.
It was great advice for him to do every day, because as an outsider, Cicero, Marcus Cicero, stood very little chance of being elected as consul. So he always had to remind himself just what he was up against.
He sounded to me there like a sports psychologist telling him to visualize, you know, imagine yourself.
Oh, absolutely.
Being consul of Rome. I also love this line. He wrote, now, my brother, you have many wonderful qualities, but those you lack you must acquire, and it must appear as if you were born with them.
Absolutely. Cicero, like I said, was a fairly shy and reserved person. So Quintus wanted him to learn to be an actor. And that's really at the heart of a lot of the advice he gives him, is how to act like a person who cares about voters, even if you really don't.
So he tells him, learn to be flattering to people. Don't be so stiff around people.
Oh, absolutely. Flatter people shamelessly, no matter what their social station in life. Shake their hand, look them in the eye, and make them believe that you really care about them.
What's some other political advice that you find still germane to elective politics?
Oh, there's so much in the letter. First of all, he says to make sure that your family and friends are on board before you decide to run for office, because things that can go wrong will very often originate with those closest to you. One of his best pieces of advice is promise everything to everybody and to adapt your message to the particular audience of the day.
Yes, I guess in ancient Rome, all politics was pretty local and pretty personal.
Oh, it was. There was no such thing as an absentee ballot. If you were a Roman citizen and you wanted to vote in the elections, you had to come physically to Rome to do it.
So tell us about whom Marcus Cicero was running against and what the outcome of the 64 election was for consul.
Well, he was running against four or five other people, and two of them were a bit of a challenge. One was named Antonius, and the other was named Catiline. And Catiline was a person who would, a year or two later, try to overthrow the Roman government. And Cicero managed to defeat him, to expose the conspiracy. But Cicero had a very tough race, but he did manage to win the consulship.
There were two winners, though.
Yes, there are always two winners. Antonius was the other one, but Cicero was elected as the chief consul.
Now, I was thinking about negative campaigning in this year's Republican primaries. In this case, when Quintus was writing to his brother of Antonius, who was the second-place finisher, he wrote scathingly about him. He said, how can the man establish friendships when he can't even remember anyone's name?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of Quintus's piece of advice, is always remember the names of your supporters. That was one of the tamer things he said about Antonius. He reminded Cicero to expose all of the sexual scandals that Antonius had been involved in, which were pretty bad. He got elected anyway, but still, that was important. Was to always keep in mind your opponent's weaknesses and to exploit them.
Well, Philip Freeman, thanks a lot for talking with us about your new translation of How to Win an Election, An Ancient Guide for Modern Politicians.
Oh, my pleasure.